Hi, welcome to CSI on Fire, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the fire investigation community. I'm your host, Mike Molden, and episode after episode we'll attempt to excavate the often difficult but always fascinating world of the fire investigator. Okay, so here we go. Welcome to CSI on Fire, your fire investigation podcast. Got two fantastic guests. A little bit unique today. It's the first time ever we've had two guests on at one time, so going to take a little bit more management from me, I think. But I've got two fantastic guests. I've got Rodri Jones. I've got Richard Wood. One Antipodean, so well done, Richard, the first Australian on. And Rodri's obviously Welsh, Rodri Jones by his Welsh name. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, so let's start off as I always do. I don't introduce you, I let you introduce yourselves. So, Rodri, should we start with you? Let's background and how you've ended up on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks. Hello to all the listeners. Hope you're well. My name is Rodri Jones. I work for Greater Manchester Fire Service. I've been a fire officer for a couple of years now. And I really got an interest in wildfires in 2018. In 2018, I was actually an incident commander involved in the 2018 wildfires in and around Manchester, which garnered quite a lot of attention, both domestically and internationally. We were dealing with a wildfire for about 3 or 4 weeks. And at that time, I was asking myself, how do these wildfires start? I was curious to understand that a bit better. Later on in 2018, I actually joined the fire investigation team in Greater Manchester Fire Service. My curiosity continued from there, and it gave me a bit of a platform to try and find out a bit more about wildfire investigation. But what I established is that in the UK, no one was really interested in that particular facet of investigation. So I decided to go on my own little journey and find out as much as I could, which gave me the opportunity to meet people like Richard, other international wildfire investigators who have been doing it for quite a few years. As I continued on that journey, I had the opportunity to host and chair a National Fire Chiefs Council webinar on fire investigation. That was back in 2020 during the COVID years. Richard was one of the speakers, and there's a few other people on there who were able to start that conversation around the benefits of doing wildfire investigation. My journey then continued with a master's degree in fire investigation, so I enrolled in that with the University of Central Lancashire. And amongst other subjects, I focused really on wildfire investigation. So I was starting to build a bit of a name for myself. I was by no means an expert, but I was maybe seeing myself more as a pioneer who was trying to continue that conversation. That then led me to being offered the opportunity to go to work for the Forestry Commission on a secondment earlier this year. So it was a 3-month project where I started to look at this in more detail and see what is possible. As part of that project, I wrote a report, which is now available. And one of the key recommendations in that report is what we should be trying to do is establish wildfire investigation here in the UK by training up current fire investigators and other people who work in that sector. That's where I've got to, basically, and that's where we are now.
Okay, fantastic. And Richard, do you want to come in there and introduce yourself?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks, Mike. It's great to be involved in this podcast. And, you know, coming from Australia and my background, I guess wildfire investigation has really become a passion of mine through my fire service career. I initially started work as a law enforcement police officer here in Australia and worked for a number of years in country and city policing. And at the same time, I was also volunteer firefighting. And it was a bit of a blend of skills, I guess. I was doing a lot of fire management work, and I eventually gave up the police work and moved over into wildfire management and was a controller for an area in New South Wales and the east coast of Australia, one of the most fire-prone areas, in fact, of Australia itself. We had major national parks that bordered on urban areas, and as a result of that, there was certainly a high incidence of wildfire. And I guess that really got me involved from the very early stages of how these fires are starting. And I guess one of the turnkey points for my career was I was a fire incident controller on a major fire during a very bad fire year in 1994 in New South Wales. And there was basically too many fires for our agencies to manage, and there was very few resources available. And it was basically a matter of prioritising which of the fires we could handle that time. And one of the fires I was working on, I'd done a night shift, and I remember distinctly going up in a helicopter the following morning and surveying the work we'd done overnight. And I discovered another fire, and it was actually on an access track in a coastal area of New South Wales. And as a consequence of that, the fire weather that day was very bad, and we had that fire ran hard, and I then took the night shift again and managed that fire incident. And what happened was around 3 a.m, I got an urgent call from one of my commanders. I was out the line, said we'd had a tree fall on a fire tanker, and as a consequence of that, unfortunately, one of my firefighters was killed. And it borne in my mind, because we had major inquiries into those sort of incidents out of that fire season, but there was a fire in my mind that was deliberately lit, and to date, no one's been held accountable for that, and it actually claimed the life of a firefighter. And that really got me involved at that point of going over to the US and getting training in America in wildfire investigation and doing this properly, because at that point in Australia, we didn't have that expertise readily available. Our organisation was primarily a fire service. We put the fires out. The cause of the fire is not our responsibility. It was sort of the attitude back then. And as a result of doing an advanced course in California, I brought back material to our fire agency and established wildfire investigation for our New South Wales Rural Fire Service, as it was back then in 2000, and built that capacity up to the point that I left it with over 100 authorised investigators and qualified and equipped investigators around the state, which to this date is now investigating fires on a daily basis. And my career sort of spurned from that into the national level, and I got involved in writing the national arson policy after bad fires we had here in 2009 as well, the Black Saturday fires, which killed 73 people. Again, another major fire season that really makes the reality of the risk of fire in this country very real. And my engagement from that point on was joining the National Wildfire Coordinating Group based in North America. And this agency, or this collective, if you like, is a representative group of all of the fire agencies in the US, land managers and so forth. And they produce all the training material, and I brought back that material. And to this date, I'm still involved in that area of collaboration. And what that has spurned on is me now retiring out of my fire service role. I now do a consultancy role of wildfire investigation and training around the world. And part of that role is also with Charles Sturt University in Australia, where I'm a lecturer in wildfire investigation here as well. So it's been a blend of, I guess, law enforcement way back, and then fire management, and then that sort of evolved into wildfire investigation. And Rodri's made the good point that in the UK there, you're just sort of getting the wheels in motion to establish wildfire investigation. And that was very much the same situation I faced back in the 2000s in Australia. We didn't have capacity. We had no skill sets. We had no equipment. And importantly, there was no structure to go around and do these investigations. And that's what I found traveling internationally, training people in the Netherlands, training people in South Korea, training people in Hawaii, Guam, US, Canada. Yeah. This whole process is identical wherever you go around the world, because all we're doing is interpreting fire patterns, and the whole take-up has been very satisfying because of the way that it actually assists in the management of fire.
Yeah, sure. You're both pioneers, really, but you in Australia and Rodri in the UK. And I think from my experience from law enforcement background as well, I had a few bodies turn up on heaths and fires and stuff, and sort of establishing whether who they were and whether they're there before, et cetera, or after. And wildfires really kind of, I'm completely, hands up, full disclosure, I'm completely ignorant about them, really. And I think there is a massive need and a massive train. So maybe we come back to you, Rodri. Why are the investigation, why do we want to look at wildfires? What's important about wildfires? And obviously in the UK, I think with global warming, we're starting to see a bit more, but we've always had heath fires. So why are you pushing now? What's the motivation now to sort of get this off the ground in the UK?
Yeah, the research I did on this over the last few years has certainly led me to realise that wildfires in the UK is an ever-increasing problem. We're seeing more and more due to climate change and a number of other factors. And those wildfires, as we've seen in the media, on July 19, 2022, we saw some serious wildfires in and around the south of England, which caused damage to property. And of course, where there's property, there are people. One of the main objectives of a fire and rescue service is to prevent fire. And we prevent fires through learning what exactly causes fires. And obviously, we want to prevent fires to protect people from harm and injury from those fires. That is one of the reasons I was interested in this, because I wasn't absolutely convinced that we truly understand what is causing wildfires in the UK. Conversely, if we were to have a wildfire that killed someone, We know as fire investigators, we're asked to investigate the scene to establish the origin and cause to then give evidence in the coroner's court. So the coroner can understand what's happened to try and prevent it happening in the future. But of course, the family can get some kind of closure so they understand what's happened to their loved one. It was clear to me that this is something that we don't have in the UK. Of course, one of the reasons being that we haven't really seen the kind of events that they have in Australia and the US. But given the increase in wildfires, it is very likely to happen. We're going to be called to investigate, and we want to be able to narrow down the cause as best we can. That's our role as fire investigators. And in the absence of having the skills and experience and knowledge to do that, I felt there's a risk that we are going to do it blindly and we're going to give it the best attempt, but we're not going to get the right answers for the benefit of preventing the wildfires in the future and giving evidence in court. I felt essentially there was a gap there and we need to try and fill that gap because there's going to be a lot of benefits by doing that.
So take us into your Forest Commission investigation or research and stuff. Tell us a little bit about that and what causes fires. Let's go through the steps and see what causes fires and what your research kind of, what born out of it.
I mean, we always have to start as fire investigators with our methodology, which is the scientific method. And of course, within that method, we need to collect data to try and establish what may have caused a fire. In order to do that, we need to know what kind of data we're looking to collect. So of course, there is the element of being able to understand a wildfire investigation scene, but then there's also that element of trying to understand what kind of ignition sources may cause these wildfires when we come to the more of the analysis stage. One thing that needs to be understood about wildfires is that there are some causes, actually, that are probably not as likely as we commonly think. We have been given information about what can cause wildfires and fires in general through various media platforms. Movies do a great job of creating myths around causes of fires. There has been somewhat of a myth created around some of the causes of wildfires. One in particular is the cigarette as a cause of wildfire. Whilst you can never rule that out, the likelihood is extremely low. The circumstances needed for that to be the ignition source have to be very finite. One or two aspects that are particularly key: the wind, the strength of the wind, the type of fuel in question, and the moisture content of that fuel, the relative humidity, and the temperatures. In the UK, we just don't really get into those kind of conditions generally. And even in places like Australia and US, those conditions are not as rare, but the factors just don't quite manifest themselves in a way that propagates a cigarette as a fire. And lots of testing has been done on this. And I know Richard has done some research in that area, and there is research that's been done in the UK. From that research and the collected experience of wildfires investigators across the globe, I think it's not unfair for us to say that a cigarette is an unlikely cause of a wildfire. However, we do often see prevention campaigns centered around the cigarette as one of the main causes of fire. So that gives people a false impression, but it also can create a level of bias within our fire investigators. They can go to fire scenes, they can see a collection of cigarettes near where they think is the origin of the fire, and they can be very quickly anchored to that and then say, well, clearly it must have been a cigarette that caused the fire. Whereas the reality is that's probably not the case. And I know Richard has a lot of experience in that area where he has seen causes of fires being put down as cigarettes, and subsequently he's investigated or other people investigated and they've established that not to be the cause. That's very important that we look at the causes of fires, try and understand whether or not it's a likely or unlikely one, coupled with the need to better understand how we collect data on wildfire scenes. So cigarettes is probably one of the causes that I try to look at the most and try to articulate to people that you should not be maybe anchoring yourself too much. There are other ones, and I'll happily talk about them, but I know Richard is probably keen to examine this one a bit more.
Yeah, sure. Let's bring Richard in there. Richard, same sort of comment. What have you got to say about that?
Yeah, Mike, Rodri's spot on. It's been very much a myth of every roadside fire must have been a discarded cigarette. And as a consequence, you know, in our country, even our statistics in the past have obviously been skewed because our fire agencies, you know, we're our own worst enemy. We tick that box and it means nothing else happens about the cause of that fire and any sort of follow-up. And when we do the tally at the end of the year, we're saying, geez, we're getting a lot of cigarette-caused fires. Look at all these spike of cigarette ignitions that are being reported by our fire service. Whereas basically it's a guess, you know, when it boils down to it, there's no evidence that's supporting the fact that the cigarette ignited the fire. One of the key points we've been finding in the research is that a discarded cigarette just placed on top of a very fine and very highly cured fuel sort, such as very fine grass, is not going to ignite that grass. It has to actually be buried within that cigarette, or the cigarette butt has to be buried within that fuel source. And very importantly, what we're also finding, there needs to be a constant wind influence on the blowing tip of the cigarette so that at least 30% of the cigarette is actually in contact with that very fine dry fuel. For that to occur, from someone's discarded a cigarette out of a motor vehicle, it's a pretty rare circumstance to actually make all those conditions line up. And some of the work I've been doing with my colleagues in Canada is we've been looking at what sort of distances a discarded cigarette will travel from a moving vehicle. And very often it barely gets to the side of the roadway because of the influence of the wind and travel path. So, you know, when it boils down to it, you know, a lot of roadside ignitions that I've looked at in the past are things such as catalytic converter breakdown. You're finding sections of exhaust that have collapsed within the catalytic converter of a petrol-powered vehicle. That then gets ejected out of the tailpipe, is of the sufficient temperature to light the grassland fuel. And very often you might see a number of these ignitions mechanically once these things break down. There might be a number of those ignitions on a roadside. And again, our firefighters think, oh, I've got an arsonist working here. We've got six independent fires. Well, no, if you actually do the investigation, you can find this evidence that will link it. There's a broad category that we look at across the board of fire cause when we look at wildfire cause. And the process is identical, I guess, from, as Rodri said, using the scientific method of analysing all the information you've got available, looking at the scene, and then looking for evidence and then aligning that evidence up against the cause itself. And one of the big things that I tend to find internationally is the deliberately lit fire is often overlooked because we haven't done a good investigation. There hasn't been a scene examination. There's no follow-up of circumstances. What might have been assumed to be cigarettes that have been discarded out of a vehicle along a stretch of highway over weeks, months, and even years is often put down to actually we've got an arsonist working in this area and we haven't done the homework. So therefore, how can we even go anywhere near identifying who's responsible? And that's the whole bedrock of doing this wildfire investigation process.
Sure. And just picking up from what you said there, what are the sort of things that we would look at? If I, as I've already said, I'm a bit ignorant around the wildfires, but what sort of evidence do you look for? How do you establish that origin? Take us through an investigation and what you might actually, as a wildfire investigator, look for.
Sure. I've done structure fire investigation in the past as well, and they're really chalk and cheese. The process is similar in that you're working a fire scene, looking for evidence of the effects of fire to determine. You haven't got an enclosed environment. You haven't got a sealed area and constant fuel within a package of a house, for instance. You're looking at an open area. You've got varying fuel conditions, the grassland condition, the rate of curing of grass, the type of vegetation that's involved, and then the influence of weather and the influence of topography on top of that. And all these things combine and will influence the way that a fire burns. In essence, what the investigator and the process requires is to determine where the hottest part of the fire is and start to identify what we call fire pattern indicators, where this fire has taken off to, if you like, as the direction of the wind has pushed it from an origin point. And then you're working back identifying these fire pattern indicators, of which there's 11 categories, and is basically the way that the fire interacts with combustible and non-combustible items that in that fire patch. Eventually you're narrowing down to where the coolest part of the fire is, because that's traditionally where wildfires started. They start small, they start with low intensity, as opposed to a structure fire where you've got a high intensity origin. That tends to be where to look for the cause. So once you find what we call the specific origin area and the ignition area, it's a matter of being down on hands and knees and then looking for evidence of fire cause. And we've been able to find match heads, for instance. We've been able to find pieces of catalytic converter and pieces of carbon from exhaust systems and rocks that have been hit by machinery where there's been sparks that have then caused the fire.
Okay.
But if you don't do that work, you've basically got a dartboard. You're not providing any value to a statistical process at all.
Do you kind of get, I'm thinking now a fire started and there's a strong wind blowing, you kind of get a flat V pattern, or is there any kind of patterns that you would look for to kind of indicate the area of origin? Or is it just, as you said, the kind of coolest area and smallest area?
It's very much a matter of identifying those fire pattern indicators within the ignition area where the fire is burning and it's very cool early stages. And
yeah,
traditionally, a strong wind will produce a V pattern. You're correct. And that is one of the categories of fire pattern indicator. But we also look for things such as protection, which is the way in which a fire will move up to and beyond an object. And that'll then create its own area that's protected from, for instance, from where the fire has originated. Things such as angle of char, the way that fire interacts around small bushes and trees and the char marks it'll leave. One of the critical things with this whole process is to have basically a fire management background, because you need to understand the way that fires will burn, because it's not cookie cutter. The different conditions will influence the way the fire is going to travel and the intensity and so forth. So purely walking into a cold fire scene without any fire experience can be very challenging. And that's why when it boils down to it, a lot of the people that I train are fire managers or career fire managers that have an understanding of fire behavior, and they can blend that. Then we add the icing on the cake, if you like. Well, this is what you now need to do and to find the origin.
Okay. And if I come back to Rodri, so what's the current situation then in the UK? Is your research being taken forward? Is there going to be a new body? Are you going to start training local FIs, local fire service FIs to sort of undertake this work? Where are we at with that?
That's certainly my aspiration. And through the project, there are other people who are now coming on board. And I think it's taken time for people to realise some of the benefits of doing wildfire investigation in the UK. Whether you're a fire investigator or you work as a prevention manager, or you work for other stakeholders, the Forestry Commission, DEFRA, there are clearly some benefits that people are waking up to. If we just kind of go back to what Richard was saying there in terms of the approach to doing a wildfire investigation, you can see straight away it's quite technical. There are differences to a structural fire investigation. And I think it takes some time for fire investigators to realize that it's not a question of just turning up and putting your finger up in the air and hoping for the best and hoping that if you follow the scientific methodology, you'll get an answer. Of course, that's the methodology you need to follow, but you need to know what data to collect, how to collect it, and then obviously how to analyze it. And Richard has said to me in the past, from his experience, you just need to keep banging the drum. Keep banging the drum, keep making noises. People will slowly start to appreciate that you do need to have technical knowledge and skills to do this. In terms of other people, the stakeholders, the Forestry Commission, DEFRA, land managers, they see the benefits of understanding the causes of wildfires to help them prevent them in the future. One of the causes that is mentioned within the report are disposable barbecues, which do get a terribly bad press for understandable reasons. They are certainly potential causes of wildfires. Having said that, not quite as unlikely as the cigarette. There just doesn't seem to be enough of a body of evidence to say, well, they absolutely always are. Now, there are lots of campaigns around trying to ban them, completely ban them, but there are dangers to doing something like that without giving it enough thought. There can be unnecessary consequences of banning something. People like to barbecue. We love the Great British Barbecue in the summer. People like to go to outdoor spaces. If they can't get hold of one of these instant barbecues, is that going to stop them from barbecuing? No, it's probably not. They're going to try alternative forms of barbecuing, which are probably more likely to cause the wildfire. This project also gave us the opportunity to look at, are we steering our prevention campaigns in the right ways? Wildfires are caused 99% of the time by human behavior. That's been well researched and looked at. Human behavior is down to people not fully understanding the risk that they bring to rural areas where we see lots of the wildfires. We do need to be mindful of that. We do need to be mindful of, if we're going to do wildfire investigation, let's make sure that we utilize that knowledge to inform people of what can cause these wildfires and then how then that leads to prevention. This project and the direction it's taking, it's got a number of different benefits. One of the benefits is clearly, as Richard has articulated, there is a technical side to wildfire investigation. So if we can upskill our fire investigators, they can turn up to scenes, greater level of confidence, more accuracy in terms of the origin cause findings. That can be utilized then by fire and rescue services. And we hope these situations don't happen, but if some people are injured or die from wildfire, then we can provide answers. And of course, as Richard has said, there is deliberate wildfire setting. It is a problem, certainly is a big problem in the UK. We can then hopefully ensure there's justice is put upon those people who decide those wildfires. But we can also then start to promote within public behaviour where it is they need to really not do things, where it is that they are the problem. They are not necessarily going out into rural spaces to deliberately start fires, but their behaviours in terms of what they bring to those places will. This project will hopefully start to address the problem from a holistic point of view, not just simply we can now catch more people who start wildfires. No, hopefully what we can do is change how the public perceive wildfires and the role that they play in preventing them from happening.
Yeah, sure. To come back to Richard, statistically, is there any analysis around, I'm from law enforcement, you're from law enforcement, in terms of actual convictions of arsonists? How do you, in your experience, because again, UK-wise, Roger said, I think in the UK, we're just waiting for the first fatality in, and I think maybe that will probably elevate the whole investigation. But obviously in Australia and America and Hawaii recently, they've obviously had mass fatalities in that sense. So how do you go about identifying individuals who believe it to be an arson?
Mike, it's a real blend of skill set. I mentioned before about the need to have law enforcement and fire service backgrounds. And what I promote is particularly, and it's worked well here in Australia, is having task force arrangements that have a blend of fire people in amongst the police people dedicated looking at wildfires over a summer period. And the beauty of that is that the police people on the block know how to look for crims. They have a background of database of intelligence that they can feed into, but they're a bit light on when it actually boils down to, well, how are these fires starting and where are they occurring and what are the weather conditions that are influencing why these fires are starting on certain days, for instance. The blend of the skill set that comes to the table is the fire people can add that value and the police people can add the criminal investigation value. And at the end of the whole process, it makes for a very successful model that works a lot better. And what I tend to find is where things are falling down is when there's no cross correlation between law enforcement and fire service. It's basically fire service takes the attitude, well, we're not police. Arsonists are the police problem. We'll just let them know where the fire occurred and it's their issue. It's totally unfair. You know, you can't expect a very busy law enforcement agency devoting time into what may be just minor fires on the roadside. So your question about how many people are we actually catching? Well, truth is we really don't know because at the end of this whole process, there's a lot of people out there that I suggest is are out there lighting fires and we're not detecting them because they're learning this skill of how to light fires successfully without being caught. And there's some very good cases that have come up in the past where you're not looking at people that have been lighting fires over a number of days. There's cases that we use, particularly when I'm doing training in relation to serial arsonists, that go back 10, 15, 20 years of fire lighting. And these people are out there lighting every year on year when the conditions are right. And they're not being caught because of gaps, I guess, in the whole investigation process, as I alluded to before. So we're getting a lot better, and in particularly, there's some advanced training courses that we deliver now that look purely at serial arson in wildfire and the things to look for. And when you're actually burrowing down into why people light fires, it's the same crime triangle that applies to any sort of criminal activity. And if you've got a motivated offender, if the arsonist wants to go and light a fire, he's got a suitable, or she has got a suitable target, be it a reserve or national park, and the conditions are right. It's middle of summer, things are drying out. And importantly, if there's no guardian, if there's no oversight by anyone, there's no deterrent, there's no investigation role, it's not promoted in the area. This is where the people have basically a free-for-all. They've actually seen lighting a fire. They're not going to be caught very easily. that's where this investigation collaboration model comes into play, because that can then identify even where fires may be lit in the future and allow for proactive investigation opportunities. That's happened in the past. There's been options to identify these people as they're in the act, because we've looked carefully and analysed all the data in the past.
Yeah, great. I mean, I know arson is good enough to convict even in an urban setting, let alone a kind of rural setting, in a wildfire kind of setting. So, I mean, I know Hampshire, do a bit of work with Hampshire Fire and Rescue, and they have an embedded sort of police team, and they're an arson fire investigation task force as opposed to separately. And at crime scenes, you know, we would work tripartite. It would be fire, police, and then sometimes forensic scientists as well. But yeah, I think that really works better in collaboration as opposed to separate silos, if you like. I'm glad to see, when I first started my career, it was very much a them and us kind of mentality. And thankfully, that's kind of broken down over the years. And we see ourselves as the three services as opposed to just separate bodies trying to do separate things. But okay, fantastic. I mean, again, where are we in the UK training wise, Rodri? Are you proposing, is there any proposed courses, or is the fire services looking at dedicated courses with Richard, for example, or anything like that?
Yes, that's certainly the aspiration. And if I just kind of come back to your previous question, I can certainly answer that by linking the two together. I picked up on a few words that you both said there. The word silo came up a couple of times. So certainly at the beginning of this journey that I've had with wildfire investigation, I started where it was just something that interested me. And it's obviously led on to the Forestry Commission secondment and the report that I produced. It's now got to what I would say more of a strategic level than just someone who has an interest in something and went out to try and get some answers. And one of the issues I established is that we do kind of work in silos is a common problem, certainly when you've got organizations like Fire and Rescue Services and the police force and other stakeholders. But with wildfires, we've all got this common sort of agreed objective that we want to see less wildfires, because there's plenty of reasons why they're not good for us. This project, what it's allowed us to do is to bring people together, I think. A lot of appreciation I've got from that is the place where Richard came from. He was very much started off as a pioneer, and his experience is, if you bring people on board to this and we all work together to try and achieve that single objective of let's do something to prevent wildfires, it makes life so much easier. Where we are at now in terms of trying to develop this further is to create courses. But those courses won't exclusively just be for public sector fire investigators. What we want is a number of different courses which would upskill landowners, people who work for the Forestry Commission, other agencies who work in rural spaces. So one of the courses that, and these are off-the-shelf courses, and Richard has been heavily involved in these, is the FI 110 course, which is quite basic in some regards. It helps to get an understanding of where the fire may have started and look at examining some of the causes. Because for some of these agencies, they won't be doing the crime work. They won't be providing answers for the police and the courts. But what they want to do is understand what's happening in their area. How can they then target effort to try and reduce the wildfires from happening in their area? If they establish that in some places, recreational areas, people are coming in and the fires are starting there, then police may not be able to resource dealing with that, but those agencies can then focus attention there and do something about it. So there's obviously a clear benefit then in terms of wildfire prevention. But then there are other courses which then would allow investigators to be upskilled to do investigations where they can get a reasonable idea of the origin and cause, and then potentially provide evidence to the court, whether that's the coroner's court or the criminal court, for those situations where it's a lot more serious and people do want answers. And then we want to try and ensure that someone is found accountable for their actions. Those courses, like I said, are off-the-shelf courses. They exist. But what we need are people like Richard to be able to come into the UK and help us develop and design those courses. That's one of the key recommendations of this report. The aspiration now, moving into 2024, is that we take the project to the next stage. We've got some early buy-in from a number of different stakeholders, and that's what we need to continue to have. We can't do this as a silo entity. The Fire and Rescue Services, they're stretched in some regards as they are. Fire investigation, as an entity isn't necessarily the sole responsibility of the fire service. We don't actually have to investigate fires. We do it because we've obviously got the skills to do it. Any kind of courses, any kind of development of this project is going to need financial resources. If we can pull together all these agencies, much like Richard has experienced in the past, then hopefully that gives that platform to take it forward. And once people see the greater benefits of doing this, and that if we prevent wildfires, the fire service will spend less time dealing with them, police forces will obviously spend less of their hours, or will at least be able to potentially get some successful convictions. And those other agencies, the Forestry Commission, well, it's clearly very important to them that they protect the areas that they're responsible for. Hopefully, the conversation carries on. Hopefully, we get to a point where we can fund getting the likes of Richard and other people over. And then we will basically take those courses, the FI110, the FI210, and we'll just make them bespoke for the UK, because there are elements that we'll need to consider in terms of legislation here in the UK. And once those courses are available, we think, because people are interested in what we're doing, they will send investigators, whether that's public sector fire investigators or people from the Forestry Commission, to come and do the basic courses. And once that's established, then hopefully it will just continue from there, really.
I mean, I know from my own forces that I've worked in, become more and more common to have a rural crimes sort of dedicated officer. So I think that's an area to target along with CSIs in terms of that. But I think we don't do politics, but obviously we have police and crime commission and they get voted in. And in a rural county, I'm from Devon, so in a rural county like mine, rural affairs, rural crime is high on the agenda. So I think that hopefully that will happen. Rich, coming back to you, any kind of comment upon that? Or just before you start, one thing I wanted to say was that, what about proactive? You've kind of indicated there might be some proactive stuff, but I can see using an analyst, for example. What's your experience in Australia using an analyst to try and identify hotspots and then maybe do some proactive drone scanning or some wildlife cameras, that sort of stuff?
Look, it's a good point, Mike. I'll just jump back to what Rodri was talking about. He was quoting things like FI110 and 210, and people are probably thinking, well, what the hell's that about? And basically what they are is three tiers of training course that the National Wildfire Coordinating Group in the United States, which I mentioned before, I'm a member, which they've produced these sort of three tiers. And the first tier, 110, that Rodri suggested, is basically a course for the first responding crews, the eyes and ears on the ground that first turn up to a wildfire. If it's only 1 hectare in size and it's a one-off incident, I mean, we don't investigate every wildfire we have in Australia. It's physically impossible. Same as, I guess, structure fires in the UK. Not every structure fire is formally investigated, but the role of the first responding crew is really vital, because their input into information as to the cause of that fire is going to trigger the next stage of investigation, if it's necessary or not. So this 110 course is an entry-level course that firefighters and station officers, for instance, on the ground, or land management crews can do. So when they turn up to a fire scene, what are the basic things to look for? How do you determine where this fire might have started? And this is a very quick and slick course that provides these pinpoints of where to start to look for evidence and where to start to look for cause. And then we're starting to get more accurate reporting, and that's the base model of where we need to take this. And obviously, if there's a need for an investigator then to formally investigate that fire, the FI210 course, which is the Wildland Scene Origin and Cause Determination Training course, it's a more involved course, as it suggests, goes for 1 week. But what that does is enable the attendees to physically examine the scene more clinically and then look for a cause based on these fire pattern indicators I mentioned earlier. And then it then allows for evidence of fire cause to be married up against those incidents. Prosecutions and prevention programs and everything else can then stem around the fact that, look, we're getting numerous fires in this area. It might be because of land management practices, of stubble burning at the wrong time of year, or something very obvious that we need to report on. Or it might be more sinister, if we've got an arsonist working in the area, because every Thursday afternoon on a fortnightly basis, I'm getting a fire in this area. The second level then can lead to the third level, which is the FI310 course, which is the serial wildland arson course I mentioned earlier, which provides that higher level of integration of law enforcement and fire service investigator. And what that'll allow them to do is to go to a fire scene and look at data from an analyst's point of view. And you mentioned a crime analyst, which is a key role in this whole process. It doesn't have to be all that intricate in the early stages, you know, just purely having a GPS plot of every fire incident we go to is a great opportunity to see, hey, we're starting to get a pattern of fires along this road or this freeway or what have you. But then when you're starting to look at this serial arson investigation, you're really looking at more high-level work, and that's where the team effort of law enforcement, fire agency, and land management. Rodri mentioned UK Forestry. Land managers have a big buy-in on this. They know their patch. That's a great opportunity for input into, well, why are we getting fires in this area? We might have a dispute with a landowner that abuts the national park. There might be some trigger points in amongst that. Who knows? But without having all that buy-in, and one of the things that I always recommend is, even before these fires start, is to have some basic agreement on how we're actually going to work together, and having memorandums of understanding and mutual aid agreement documentation all signed up. So when the rubber hits the road and we start getting fires, people aren't saying, well, who's going to pay for this? Because I'm not going to put my hand in my pocket. And so agencies are sort of at 20 paces and it's too late. The fire has already taken off. But having that opportunity to analyze more incidents is part of the winning of this process. And time again, I see in many jurisdictions is you say, well, where's your fire problems? Well, we're not really sure. We've had a few fires here and a few fires there. Things aren't even mapped. You're not even looking at the bigger picture. It's a step-by-step process.
Yeah. And do you use, on the proactive side, do you use drone technology? Do you use wildlife cameras, that sort of stuff?
I guess without giving too much away, there's all sorts of technologies now that are okay. Really useful. Because one of the big challenges, we're looking at remote areas where these fires are being lit very often. They're always in secluded patches. You know, an arsonist, for instance, will target an area where they know that they can move into their chosen patch, light the fire, and get away from there undetected, as opposed to, say, the structure fire arsonist who's lighting dumpsters at the back of a commercial residence or premises, rather. CCTV comes into play, obviously, in an urban area. We don't have that luxury, or we tend not to have that luxury in rural areas, but there are measures that we can now look at that can combine technology and provide that help. And I always say, you know, one of the biggest things that I see, in, particularly in a rural area where you haven't got a large movement of people in and out, is the local information, the Crime Stoppers numbers. Many cases have been solved because people are all alert that, hey, I've seen this vehicle coming and going over the last few weeks. Now we've got a fire. It's that sort of information that can really tip the scales on catching people as well. But look, the technology is there. There's opportunities to do it. And it's a bit like, you don't go and lock down a whole borough or subdivision or area where fires are occurring just in case we might have another fire. Mm. You need to use the number crunching behind the scenes to be able to target where you're going to look for the next fire. And that's why the analysis process is so vital.
Yeah. And I think that you've highlighted a really good point. There's a local people, and Rod, the same, you know, local people know rural wardens, that kind of stuff, forestry commission officers. They know their patch. They know who farms those areas. They know who should be there, who is common to there. It's interesting that whilst an arsonist might want an area which is other way, tucked out away, is remote, then other people do tend to see them coming in and out and will go, well, hang on, what are you doing down here type thing? Yeah, I think that local knowledge is often really key to it. I've found this absolutely fascinating. I've learned a great deal today. In terms of like courses and things, if I'm sat at home, if I'm one of my listeners and I'm sat at home and I really want to get involved in this, how would I go about it? You've mentioned the three courses. Are the three courses, you have to do the first one to end up doing the last one, or how does that work? And where can we get this training?
It depends, obviously, where your listeners are based, but internationally, there's a number of opportunities that these courses are provided. I think first and foremost, there's no need to actually do the FI110 before you do the FI210. That's not necessary, but there's certainly a need to do the 210 before the serial arson course is undertaken, which is the 310 course. But opportunities to provide training. I mean, personally, I now run a consultancy that I do this training internationally. It's readily available material, but one of the clinches is to have the background in the area. It's like any sort of knowledge base. Particularly, I find, and I harp back to this fire behavior issue, is it's not something you can read out of a book today and learn and apply it tomorrow. It takes time. It's like riding a bicycle. You know, eventually you'll get more confident. Because of the nature of wildfires and the way that they burn, it can be very challenging. You get to a fire scene and scratch your head because the wind has done 360 degrees over the initial stages of that fire. Where did it start in that case? That can be very challenging. But we're hoping, certainly in the UK, that there's going to be opportunities, obviously, down the track that more courses will be offered. I've trained people, for instance, in the Netherlands Fire and Police Departments. We've had also people from around Europe attend a number of those courses in the early stages as well. And I think what it actually identifies that I often encounter is people say, well, you can never find the cause of a wildfire because everything's black. What's the point? You can't even know where to start. And that's not the case. It's a skill set that can be applied appropriately. And on that basis, it's probably a matter of listeners just doing a little bit of research through their agencies or their organisations and identifying the need and then seeing which way we can provide it.
Okay, but is there attention for UK AFI or for some of the associations in Australia to run a course? Is it possible for, if you are, say you don't get a whole buy-in from an organisation, say Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Service, they run a course, would it be possible for individuals to come on that course or how do you envisage that happening?
The aspiration is to have the courses here in the UK. The agency or the main stakeholder that's leading on that is the Forestry Commission. They have the unique benefit of being run like more like a business than most public sectors are. They can generate income by providing courses, as well as obviously being a quasi sort of public entity. They've got this platform where they can be the people pushing this and developing the courses, and then obviously inviting or giving the opportunity to fire investigators from fire services or private fire investigators who work in the civil side of things from an insurance perspective, as well as all the links they have to, whether it's the RSPCA or one of the other stakeholders, they will be hopefully the main body that are saying, we've got the courses. They possibly be accredited by Lantra or maybe even Skills for Justice. Right now, we're just at that very early stage of trying to get as much buy-in as possible for that to happen. In 2024, we're hoping we will get to a point where we have a plan, a strategy to say, right, this is what is going to cost us here in the UK. These are the stakeholders that are interested in coming along. And then we'll establish where this course is going to be run from, hopefully an easy to get to location in the UK. And we'll very much then be looking at bringing the likes of Richard over to help us develop and make sure this course is worthwhile and meets the objectives, upskilling our fire investigators to go back out then. And if I just touch upon, we talked about analysis. It's fair to say right now, the analysis that we can do is based on the incident recording systems that we have in the UK, where that gives us a data set as to what we think has caused a fire generally into two categories, deliberate or accidental. And then there may have been the odd one or two attempts to do a wildfire investigation. By upskilling people, it benefits the analysis as well. We can then say, actually, it is one of the biggest problems we have here in the UK, deliberate fire setting. If it is, then we could certainly have the conversation with rural police teams, apply a bit of pressure and say, look, our evidence now suggests that we have a deliberate fire setting problem. And we can back that up because we've upskilled our fire investigators to be able to say that the accuracy of our determination is closer than it ever has been.
Sure.
And of course, if we do have the deliberate fire setting problem, then we can start to focus on that. Because if we are truly serious about preventing wildfires, and there are lots of other things that are done to prevent wildfires, fire investigation is by no means a silver bullet. But building and developing these courses, which was the aspiration and hopefully will happen in 2024, 2025, will only go to improving our chances at reducing wildfires for a number of reasons, but being able to analyse the cause is certainly definitely one of those. I think it wouldn't be unreasonable for me to say this. I appreciate I might be creating some bias here, that we do have a big problem with deliberate fire setting. It is certainly an issue. The whole conversation around what a wildfire arsonist looks like is certainly a good one to have. I don't know if we've got time for it today. But there are some unique facets to the wildfire arsonist as compared to a bog standard arsonist, if you can call it that. This can go wider than just obviously the courses, but the courses do lend themselves to people then having a better appreciation of the psychology of wildfire arson. And I'm sure Richard has got a lot of experience in that field as well.
Richard, do you want to come in there about some of the psychology and some of the differences between an urban fire setter and a rural fire setter?
It's an interesting field, Mike, because when you actually look worldwide at the research, there's been very limited research on wildfire arsonists. And I guess part of that problem is the small group that we deal with are very often those that are obviously been successful at one point, but they've obviously got to a point they've been unsuccessful because they've been caught. The challenge is we've got a group out there, I suggest, that have never been caught. And we don't know what's their trigger points and why things are happening in behind there. But nevertheless, there's certainly been some very good work done in the past, both here in Australia and US. The FBI did some research over a number of years ago, and a colleague of mine over there. And what we identified, or what they identified, was there's a number of triggers or motives behind a wildfire arsonist. And one of those things is excitement. And I always say a box of matches can cause total chaos to your suburb or your borough or a town area, as we've seen with some of our fires here in the past. Very cheap, very easy to get hold of, and very powerful. And when you look at things like excitement for an arsonist lighting a fire on a very bad fire day, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing. But there's other things like crimes concealment and profiteering. We often find that contractors might look at lighting fires so their earth-moving equipment can be hired so that they have a job for the next 2 weeks of putting in fire breaks and so forth. And things even like vandalism and so forth, which you see in obviously in urban settings as well, but you know, just wanton firelighting tends to be a pretty common sort of trait. But one of the key points is things like revenge. When you've got political issues, and I alluded to before with landscape or land managements rather, where it's abutting onto a national park or so forth, and there might be an issue with feral animals or weed control issues, and because there's not good collaboration, cooperation occurring, well, I'll just go and light a fire over the back fence and let that burn into the national park and that'll teach them, or have that sort of revenge impact. And I mentioned excitement, and one of the elephants in the room that I always talk about is firefighter arson, something that fire agencies tend not to want to look at. You know, it's a bad news story, but I always say you need to look at it because it's a very common issue around the world, and we're not alone here in Australia. We've had a number of firefighters, particularly in some of our volunteer organisations, where young people are trained up, they do all this work, they're ready for the fires, and then nothing happens. Particularly in a rural setting, you know, there's an opportunity to go and light a fire, and then I can go and put it out, and I can claim this hero status, if you like. It's a pretty powerful thing as well. But again, it's something that I'd suggest is over there in the UK as well that needs to be looked at. And often the agencies' attitude is a big opportunity to prevent this from happening in the first place. Make it up front when people sign up to become a firefighter. If you get caught, you'll be treated like any person on the street. You're not going to be given any favours. So it's something, again, that needs to be looked at carefully.
Yeah, and I think there's another fantastic podcast which actually really kind of got me into podcasts, is The Firebug, with about John Orr in America, who was a renowned fire investigator, one of the top fire investigators, because he was setting the fires. He's able to quite easily identify the area of origins and causes because he was actually setting them. But insurance fraud as well, I think. I don't crop loss, I guess, or property loss. And also, yeah, firefighter. I've had a couple of jobs in the private sector where a firefighter is on site at the time of the fire and then fights the fire. And yeah, some questions arise that. But it's well known. And also, there's, of course, in most retained, there's a financial incentive as well because they get extra money, double bubble, or overtime, or get called out. So fantastic. I mean, I've learned a massive amount today. Rodri, just coming back to you, I know that your paper is coming out. Is it your research paper? If people want to delve a bit deeper into this, and we'll put it up on the podcast notes anyway, where would they go to find your research? And the same for you as well, Rodri.
As it stands, if you went to my LinkedIn page, you'd be able to find it there. It's also on the UKFI page as well. But I suppose it's not as in the public domain as I hoped it would be. You know, the Forestry Commission don't generally produce reports and then put them on their website. So it has been shared really in those two places. So obviously, if you're able to share it, that would be great. And we do want it to be shared because, as I said, we're at the early stages of this. We're trying to build an army of people who would want to be wildfire investigators. We need to know that that appetite is out there, certainly for this project to be successful. It won't happen if we can't get people to subscribe to the idea that I want to be trained up in wildfire investigation. So we're hopeful that public sector will go, yeah, we can absolutely see the benefits, as well as the private sector as well. So there will be incidents that will happen that will come at a cost to an insurance company. And at some point, it may very well be that they decide that, well, we want to try and offset these costs. Can someone investigate it for us? And right now, I would say we have very few skilled wildfire investigators in the UK. Of course, they may go overseas and try and bring people over, but I think it would benefit a number of different agencies in that respect. But we need to hear back from people that, yes, this is something we want to do. And then we can take this project forward, knowing that it's financially sustainable to do so.
Sure, sure. I think, you know, what's coming across to me today and is that there are multiple stakeholders, aren't there? So I think it's a case of it's not just fire, it's not just police, it's, as you say, Forestry Commission, landowners, insurance companies, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a bit like Wayne's World, if you remember Wayne's World, like sort of build it and they will come. I think there's, from my view, just sat here, I think there would be buy-in. Where do you go from there? I guess maybe just try and get DEFRA or the commission to just to sort of appoint a course or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got the interest there. And I think we're just trying to explain to people why they need to be interested. The Home Office have shown an interest. And one of the things that's included in my report, I'd say it's straying into the unlikely, but it's another example of why it'd be useful to have skilled people to investigate wildfires. There is a thought of concept from the States that wildfire can be an act of terrorism or pyroterrorism as well. When you think of the ease, you just need someone with an ignition source on the right kind of day, perfect conditions. They could set fire to miles and miles of land, which could seriously damage the infrastructure and the economy of an area. That could be seen as a really good form of sabotage. Fire has been used for millennia to cause damage in warfare. Now, I'm not saying that's happened, but it's conceivable that someone might go, this is a threat to the UK, that we have increasing conditions for wildfires, whoever it may be, whichever agency, let's just go and set fire to somewhere. That's going to cause a problem. That's why, again, there'd be some real benefits to investigating that wildfire, because if that is the case, you've got a whole national security issue there. They're just another potential agency that would benefit from it. And I'm just hopeful that those people are, they are engaged, but they continue to be engaged, and we can certainly take this forward so that we can become like Richard has in Australia, where we've got dedicated wildfire investigators who can do the job when we need them to do the job.
Yeah, I mean, I worked for EFI Global for a while. I know we had two investigators down in the Kent wildfire, which took out an entire village. So the skill set is required. And insurance companies, obviously on the private sector side, they want that investigated. Who caused it and who we're going to claim back off of? And also on the terrorist side of things, just to cover that, Mike Harris from Cranfield, I used to run the Cranfield fire investigation courses. He came, I used to get him to come and do a whole, he did like 2 hours on terrorism, a fire as a terrorism tool type thing. It does happen. It has happened. And if you think at, maybe coming back to you, Rich, if you think about this extensive fires that you've seen in Australia, in southern parts of Europe, Spain, etc., and America and Hawaii, it is perfectly possible that terrorists or people with ulterior motives would be using that as a tool.
Oh, very much so. And provided the person knows how to light a fire successfully on a very bad day, you know, the consequences can be absolutely extreme. I also emphasise too, Mike, that it's the 1 acre or the 1 hectare fire that the fire service turns out to that is also a risk to the community. We're not talking about community members being burnt or seriously injured from the fire, but when you're responding to fire clients through a town or a country road and they're travelling at speed under lights and siren, you know, that's a risk to the community. And if there's one fire that they put out, well, that's one thing. But if there's a series of fires that, you know, we're turning out continuously to these roadside fires, the fire departments or fire brigades, fire and rescue is very busy these days. We're getting a lot of roadside fires. We need to do something about that rather than just continually respond. And the risk to a community is very high when you're responding through a heavy vehicle under lights and sirens at speed. I always say that the only reason why it's only a small fire is A, the fire service has intervened and managed to keep it small. B, the conditions aren't right for it to spread and become a massive blaze. It's a matter of balance there of, well, okay, the fire agencies are going to continue to turn out if we don't do anything about preventing the cause in the first place. And the last thing we want to see is a fatal accident from a fire unit that's turning out to a 1 hectare of grass, which is the sixth time we've turned out in a matter of weeks. What have we done about the other five fires in getting them looked at and trying to find out who or what is responsible?
Yeah, definitely.
Big part of the role. And you mentioned, Mike, too, about the litigation process. And A lot of my work nowadays is all about cost recovery from negligently caused fires. Obviously, people have had property loss and they're looking recompense, and insurance companies are now also in that line of putting their hand out to say, well, this wasn't an accident. This was negligence. Someone's responsible. And you can't obviously blame anyone if you don't have the evidence to point it to who was responsible in the first place. So that's another flip side of this whole equation of getting a very good investigation done.
Yeah, absolutely. The impact on just road closures and bits and pieces. If you've got a fire, you're going to have to put down road closures, and the impact on that. And if that's continually happening, then that's going to have an economic cost as well, isn't it? Fantastic. We're sort of getting towards the end of our time. Well, I want to do this again, really. But I just want to come back to Rodri. Is there anything? I'm still developing my interview skills. I'm an FI, so I'm not the best interviewer. But is there anything I haven't sort of asked you that you think I should ask you today? Is there anything else you want to come back to? And I'll come back to you in a minute, Rich.
Nothing that I can think of. I found it an extremely interesting, fascinating subject. And I've often said that I'm a wildfire enthusiast. And I thought twice about that and wonder what people might mean I'm saying there. So I see wildfires is going to be a continual problem, whether it's the UK or globally, due to climate change. We're going to have to adapt. We're going to have to change our behaviours. Like I said, wildfire investigation, which is certainly linked to prevention, isn't a silver bullet. There's lots of other concepts out there that we can do to help manage the risk, whether that's land management. But as I've said, 95%+ of wildfires have been recognised as being human-related. So as we've done from a domestic structural point of view, we try to understand the causes of fires in our houses, and that's led to a dramatic decrease in fires, certainly in the UK and across parts of the globe. We've done such a good job of prevention that we've started to put ourselves out of jobs in the fire service. But we need to take wildfires in the same direction, and one of the key ways to doing that is let's understand the causes. That's what I'm hoping will happen. Now, I'm very likely to be sort of stepping away from this, although I'll still be having an avid interest. It's in some ways my hobby. As someone's put it to me, we're taking the proverbial rugby ball as down as close to the try line as we can with wildfire investigation. And I've hopefully been a big part in doing that, taking that and inching it forward. I'm now going to pass it over to some other people in the Forestry Commission who will hopefully take it into 2024, 2025. And with the support of the fire investigation, forensic community, and all of the stakeholders out there, take this forward so that we can then develop wildfire investigation in the UK. We can see how that will benefit us based on certainly the successes that Richard has had in Australia.
Fantastic. And Rich, just to finish off with you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Look, it's been a great opportunity. I guess this whole discussion may have raised more questions amongst your listener group as well, which is a good thing. It needs to be explored and researched, particularly if you're in a fire-prone community and you're facing a problem of ignitions. And one of the things that I struck a number of years ago was getting inquiries from overseas fire agencies saying, I've got all these fires, I don't know where to start. And that actually spurred me into writing a book about serial wildfire arson, which I published last year, Wildfire Arson Prevention Guide. I guess if people are interested, I've got a website, which is probably the best thing to go looking for this text. But if you Google wildfirecause.com, which is my website, and I've got a link in that about this book that I've produced. And what I've really designed the text for is for fire and police agencies to be able to pick this up and basically get their head around their problem, because it'll give them an idea of where their problem's occurring, but also how to tackle it. Some very, very easy pointers of which direction to go. And ultimately, if you want to do it properly, what training courses need to be incorporated into your local area. And I guess I'll leave you with this thought is I've traveled the world with this topic, and I was up in South Korea not so long ago, and they had a fire that started beside a freeway near Seoul, and it burnt out a number of ancient buildings that were obviously on their national register. And there was great consternation about the fact that when this fire commenced, what was the cause? And it raced up this hill and it was dramatic fire. And in days gone by, it would have been put down to a cigarette. We've done some training up there over the years, and I had a word to a number of the officers, and things are turning around there. They're actually doing investigations in South Korea and their wildfire problem as well. More recently, even places up in Thailand, I was applying the same methodology. I was actually up there on vacation and there were some fires up in the hinterland in northern Thailand that looking at burn and char patterns on bamboo, it works. You can actually track a fire through that sort of vegetation. And I guess bottom line with all this business is if you take it up and you actually adopt these processes, you can have some very successful outcomes in relation to identifying the cause.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll put all of those links on. In my research, I've had a look at the book and it's got some fantastic comments on it. I liked it when you said it was written for fire and police. That means basic language and lots of pictures to me. We always like plenty of pictures in the fire and police service. So fantastic. I'll put all those links in. It just sort of leaves me to really appreciate and thank you for coming on. I really appreciate your time. As I say, first time we've ever had three of us on instead of two of us on. I hope it's worked okay. But again, thanks ever so much for coming on. I mean, it's such a fascinating subject and it's really highlighted some of the things that I'd never thought of and the reverse in the sense of instead of looking for the points of origins, there's some distinct differences there and only something that's going to develop over time. And anything we can do on the podcast or to try and help you along the line and make awareness, then don't hesitate to contact us. But as I said, I'll put all the links that you've mentioned, your papers, et cetera, and you're all in the podcast. But so thanks ever so much. I really appreciate your time. Without you guys, this would just be me wittering on, which would be incredibly boring. So again, thanks for your time. I know it's evening time there for you in Australia. I know, Rodri, you're back in the UK. So thanks very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Richard. Thanks to all the listeners for listening today. If you want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, just look for me, Rodri Jones. There isn't many Rodri Joneses out there. I'll happily try and answer any of your questions or direct you towards someone who can and is helping with this project to take it forward.
And certainly for me, Mike, a great opportunity to talk about the subject. It's a passion of mine, as you can tell, and hopefully the listeners have got something out of it.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, passion's everything, isn't it? That's why I set up this podcast is I want to bring on people who are passionate about things because people who are passionate, I think, make things happen. And as you've said, you're both, I think listeners will recognize that you've both been pioneers at different times in the development in each of our. But again, just thanks very much. I really appreciate your time. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thank you for listening to CSI on Fire. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and suggest future topics on our webpage. Remember, facta non verba. Take care, good hunting. I hope to see you on the next one. Cheers.